Today is our last class, and we are going to spend it again. We're talking about the Ising model. We're going to try to finish up the story from last time about degeneracies, and then talk about the spin correlations and symmetry breaking. Well, there's an issue. What's going on? Okay, hold on. Hi. Yeah. Okay.
But it's coming back ambiguous.
Okay.
Can I ask you just to do another one real fast?
Sure.
You just
need to do it. Maybe, yeah.
Proteins that. There are people like that who test regularly with that type of response. Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, thanks.
Appreciate it. Is that garbage?
No. You all should know, I guess, that my rapid test came back questionable.
15 minutes.
Yeah, right. Okay, so I better talk fast. Okay, good. Before they send me home. Okay, so I mean, I'm pretty sure I don't have COVID, but it's up to you. I let you know because I won't be offended if you decide to leave and watch the video. Okay, so Charlie too. So the person from the door just came and told me that my COVID test came back slightly ambiguous and had me do another one. So you can choose to go watch on video again if that feels better to you.
I mean, there's just a lot of asymptomatic COVID. Kind of COVID versus the average person. Let's go. Precious.
Okay, all right. So hopefully full hour, but okay, we'll find out. Right. So last time we were talking about the question of where did our degeneracy go? And we discovered that we have either periodic or antiperiodic. Boundary conditions. On our chain, in the fermionic language, fermions. So it's periodic if the number of spin up is, let's see, I think it was odd, right? Yes. Is odd and antiperiodic if it's even. So in this case, this odd case, periodic boundary conditions, then we have k is equal to 2 pi over n times little n. Here we have k is equal to 2 pi over n times some n plus 1, or sorry, n plus half, rather. And this is going to turn out to be basically the key difference. So our total Hamiltonian can be divided into two blocks. So this is the periodic boundary conditions and the antiperiodic boundary conditions. And we can separately do our fermionic Hamiltonian in each one. Which, as we saw, looked like this. So the difference, the only difference really seems to be that our sum on k has different values of k in these two sectors. So, however, there's another important difference. That not all the eigenstates of this thing are allowed. In fact, only half of them are allowed, because every time I, if I take a state, if I take a state psi and I act AK dagger on it, then I change the parity. Because AK dagger flips the spin up and flips the spin down. So in other words, AK dagger changes sectors, and it changes which values of K are allowed. And therefore, just acting with AK dagger takes me to a state which doesn't exist. So I can only act with something like AK1 dagger, AK2 dagger. To stay within the space. So, okay, I want to point out also, this is sort of the answer to the question that Zheng asked like earlier in this week about why does it seem like we have fermionic statistics in this model? So, like for that, but you asked like why do the most basic excitations have fermionic statistics? Like, why should that be true for the Ising model? So what we're seeing here is it's actually not true. That, or not exactly true, because the excitations that we have, in fact, have the statistics of basically two fermions, and the other type of excitation switches sectors between the two parity sectors.
Are you implying that there are some kind of fractionalization? Because we have the elementary excitation, the composite.
I'm not sure I would say it exactly like that. I'm actually not sure what the right language is to talk about the excitations between the two sectors. So because for that reason, I would hesitate to agree with that comment, but yeah, maybe.
I feel like one of the big reasons we introduced a second quantized language, so we could only write down physical states. I'm just wondering what kind of happened there.
What happened is that so basically what happened is that when we write down a model that's originally in the second quantized language, then it has to be a physical model for the reason that you said, because we define the operators that way. But in this case, these operators didn't come from any physical, didn't come directly from writing down a physical system. They came from just a mathematical trick, basically. We had spin operators, and then we did some, like, you know, we defined some new things, and we showed they happened to have the same algebra as fermion operators. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, like, those fermion operators don't necessarily correspond to real Slater determinant states.
I actually have a question about that.
Yeah.
If we excite the ground state to an excited state with some momentum k,
yes,
we could have many combinations of k in decomposing into k1 and k2.
Yes.
That means this excited state should have not definite energy, because each pair of k1 and k2 should have different energy.
So that is true, the thing you talked about is not a basic excitation, because it's not an eigenstate, right? I'm not sure that's an issue. Like there are many different particles you could write down with the momentum k. That's true, but then there's no reason why you should favor that particular equal linear combination of them over the individual ones, which are eigenstates.
But if we measure the spectral function of this model, we will get some peaks that are extremely short, meaning there are very
Yes, I think that's true.
You say you can only act with two of them.
I see. I mean, the basic the fundamental excitations, if you write that, try to write them in the spin language, and the perturbative limits turn out to be spin waves, basically, which I guess are not really sharply peaked, but okay. Okay, it's a good question, but I'm not sure that I have more to say about it right now. Okay, so we can only act with these two things. Our actual energy gap will be between the ground states in the two sectors. So now is where we come to what's really quite tricky, I think. So let's try to understand what these ground states in the two sectors actually look like. So one sector is going to have in the large H limit, we'll have the state that's all spin up. Let's say that for concreteness, I'm going to let N be even. So this case then we'll have the antiparticle boundary conditions for the fermion model, because they have an even number spin up. And then in the large J limit, the state will be found in this sector. And then the periodic boundary condition sector will include, in the large H limit, one spin flip, which has energy is E ground state plus 2H. And in the large J limit, we'll have the anti-symmetric combination and the energy is going to be larger than the one in this sector by an amount that is exponential in H over J. And the reason why you can get this splitting, if you think of it as like perturbation theory, that the number of H terms that you need to go from this state to this state, or to go from the all right to all left state, which would distinguish the energies of these two things, you need n different, you need to flip n spins to do that. Therefore, you need to go to nth order in perturbation theory, which gives you H over J to the n. I guess this is also times J. No, sorry, I shouldn't have said between the two terms, but like I'm saying is, if you want to take this state and map to this state, then you can only do this if you have at least the nth power of the Hamilton, mm-hmm. right? And that means that in perturbation theory, you have to go to nth order perturbation theory in order to get this couple, to get any kind of coupling between these two things.
Yeah.
How are the two states equal by just keeping sign? No, no, I'm sorry. They're not equal that way, but I'm saying that the Hamiltonian, like, if you write down matrix elements between the all right and all left states, like, so if I take as my basis, let this be psi 1, and this is psi 2, and then I write some H effective in the space of psi 1, psi 2. What I'll get is some matrix that looks like this. But to get this matrix, you have to go to nth order in perturbation theory. And then once you diagonalize this matrix, you get the plus sign as one eigenvalue and minus sign as another eigenvalue.
And how do we see that state in the periodic sector?
Okay, so this, yeah, this is not exactly obvious, but this all right to the n looks like all up to the n plus one flip state plus two flips, etc. And then this one is the same thing, but it's minus the state with one flip because of this eigenstate has the minus sign in it. And so then when we add these two things together, we get only this piece and we get the two flip piece and so forth. And this piece was in this sector. And then if we subtract them, we get the one flip terms and three flip terms and so forth, and that's in this sector. Okay, so this is what this looks like in the spin language. Okay, so now we're going to translate to fermion language. So the state with all up becomes my vacuum state of the C daggers. And we said that our ground state is the product on K of AK dagger, because all of these things are filled, times the vacuum state. But this is not the vacuum of C's. Let's call this 0C. This is the vacuum of the A operators. The reason being that the way I define this state is that this is the state where none of the AKs are filled, which implies that AK acting on this 0A has to equal 0 for all K. That's just a property of the algebra. So the question is, how is this state related to this state? In other words, what parity sector does this state live in? So okay. One way we can get this 0A is we could do a product on K of all the AKs acting on 0C. So this doesn't kill this state because each AK is a combination of C and C daggers. The C dagger part will survive. And here, there's an even number of factors. Which implies that the parity of 0a equals the parity of 0c, which is, as we recall, all spins up.
So,
so 0a has to be the state, it's a unique state where all the ak's acting on it give you 0. That's the rule, right? Yeah. And so this, okay, you have to renormalize it. This is not going to be normalized, but this state has this property, and it's the state with that property is unique, therefore it must be this. That's the argument.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, okay, so we know that that means that since we have an even number of sites that we've assumed, then the parity of 0a is going to be the same as this. In other words, it's going to be in the sector with the antiperiodic boundary conditions. Okay, so what do we learn from that? That means that in the antiperiodic boundary condition sector, the ground state energy is just the sum on k of Ek over 2. Over 2 is because we had this Ak dagger Ak minus half. And all the states are filled. In the periodic boundary conditions sector, this state is not actually in the sector. So ground state energy is sum on k Ek over 2 plus the minimum value of Ek over all the k's, which comes from the fact that we have to fill one state in order to get into the correct sector. Okay? Well, this is, I think, can be confusing, but so I don't know.
It seems to depend on whether n is even or odd.
Yeah, okay, so I'm doing the case of n even. We could do separately the case of n odd. It'll basically work out the same way.
But it's...
Yeah, they'll switch, but the logic is the same.
So how does it translate to, in an experiment, you will never know n is even or odd?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's see. So I didn't actually work out the odd case exactly. So I didn't know exactly where the differences are. So let's think about it for a second.
Well, how big is the minimum of Ek comparison to the sum? Like, are these terms about the same order of magnitude? No.
So this one will scale with the number of sites in the system, and this one is a constant. It doesn't depend on the system size. But in an experiment, you measure total energy, not energy per site. And so this, even though this doesn't scale with the system size, it is measurable in an experiment. So yeah, we can't get out that way. That would be nice, but we can't do that. So what we will find if we did the odd case is that we'll find the same energy gap either way. That at least is true. I think it changes which sector is the ground state. This is also going to happen, is that if I use odd, then this state and this state will both have periodic boundary conditions, and this state will have antiperiodic boundary conditions, but these two will still be the ground state, and this one will still be the excited state. So it changes which one is periodic, which one's antiperiodic, but it doesn't change the terms of the physical states, in terms of the spins, which one is the ground state, which one's not the ground state. That's the answer. So I think that there's no problem. So like all the problems came from our rewriting the fermion language. In the spin language, the ground state sector is always this one, and the excited state sector is always this one. Yeah, I think that's it. Okay, great. Okay, so then that means that our energy gap is the min on k of ek plus the sum on k equals 2 pi over n n ek over 2 minus the sum of k equals 2 pi over n n plus 1 ek over 2. And these things are the same, except they're offset by some small amount in k. And then we've got n go to infinity. And both of these convert to exactly the same integral. And so we just get the gap is equal to the min over k of ek. And this is exactly what we computed last time, which is equal to 2j times the absolute value of 1 minus g. So unfortunately, we have once again lost our degeneracy. So there's another problem here. And it turns out the problem this time is this claim. Or perhaps more so, actually, this definition. Okay, so this is correct. For g bigger than 1. And then for g less than 1, now we're going to have, we have to be a bit more careful, because it turns out that at k equals 0 and pi, in particular at k equals pi, for g less than 1, let me think through this again in real time. So after that, so let me write down the right thing. Right, so for g less than 1, a pi is equal to c pi dagger, and for g bigger than 1, a pi is equal to c pi. And the reason why this is important is that when we looked at this condition, that every a has to annihilate this 0 a, then I said, okay, from that we conclude that this 0a is defined by this equation where we multiply all the ak's on 0. But actually, in this case, the g bigger than 1 case, if we multiplied a pi on 0c, it would kill us, because a pi is equal to c pi. Then also, for all g, a0 is equal to c0. So in fact, this is sort of wrong by two different terms, or two different factors. When g is bigger than 1, there are two factors we should leave out of this in order to not kill 0c. When g is less than 1, there's only one term we should leave out, or one factor we should leave out. So, OK, let me. There's a conclusion.
We simply want it to not be killed because it's not the grounds.
The goal is that this should be true for 0A.
Yep.
And that 0A has to be a state that is a non-zero vector. So previously we said that we should define this state is equal to 0A. But if we include A0 or A pi here, then we would get 0 equals 0A. So that's not allowed. And this is one way of saying that's not allowed. The other way of saying it is we don't need to include them in these factors, because if we don't, the state we get will still be annihilated by C0 or C pi, and that's all we need. So we could both say that it doesn't work, also it's unnecessary.
So here we are looking at PBC or APBC.
Right, okay, so this issue only occurs with periodic round divisions. Because k equals 0 and pi are not in the antiperiodic case.
I think I'm overall just so confused whether these antiperiodic boundary conditions are just a mathematical fix or how to...
Essentially, that's true, yes. I'm not sure that everything I'm doing here necessarily gives a lot of physical insight. I mostly just want to do it because since we've used this Jordan Rigor transformation, I want to make sure that we know how it actually works and we're not, you know, like... So there's this question about degeneracy. Partly why I'm focusing on this is because when I first saw this in a class, the degeneracy vanished. It was actually a little slightly different. It was doing the duality between where you like invent new operators and you switch through roles of H and J. And the degeneracy seemed to switch from 2 and 1, and then you redefine your operators and then it switched to 1 and 2, but the physical system hadn't changed. And I was very confused and I asked the professor and he said, it's complicated. We're not gonna talk about that. So then I thought I should talk about it.
So the similar story applies to the Kramer-Vanier.
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly different, but yeah, the same kind of tricks you need in order to find the right degeneracies. That's right.
You were saying that for finite-sized systems, the self-duality don't hold exactly.
Yes, that's true.
So if we look at finite-sized systems,
you have to consider the boundary states. It's actually much easier to understand on a finite-sized system, actually, because there you can clearly identify difference comes from the boundaries. Whereas in the periodic system, it's much less clear to me because you don't have any boundaries. That there's no easy way to explain it. Okay, so our conclusion then finally is that for the antiperiodic boundary conditions, the energy is just indeed equal to the sum on Ek over 2. And then for periodic boundary conditions, when G is less than one, 0A is in the correct sector. Because it's the product of k not equal to zero, just k not equal to zero of ak acting on 0c. And there's an odd number of factors. And when g is bigger than 1, 0a is in the wrong sector. So in this case, we have sum on ek over 2. And in this case, we have e pi plus sum on ek over 2. And so finally, delta e is equal to e pi times the Heaviside function of g minus 1, that's 0 if you're, this is negative and 1 if it's positive, plus the thing we wrote down before, sum on k equals 2 pi over n, ek over 2 minus sum k equals 2 pi over n plus 1, ek over 2. So this is the exact answer for the energy gap. And so what you can see basically is that this piece will go to 0 as n goes to infinity. And then this piece will look like something like this. The energy gap is 0 up until g equals 1. And here, the energy gap is going to be 2 times h minus j. OK, we also had another question about we said that the energy gap at g equals 0. The cost of one domain wall is actually 4j because we actually need 2 domain walls. And now we can understand why this happens. It's because the cost is from ak dagger a minus k dagger because we're only allowed to do 2 excitations. So even though each of these carries energy 2j, the lowest allowed excitation actually has energy 4j. OK, so this is kind of like a very messy and complicated argument. But it at least seems to have worked. Oh, yeah, sorry, this is delta E. Yes. Yeah, so the fact that it's 0 here means we have the exact degeneracy in the ground state we wanted to define. I should also note that if you want to be more careful than just letting n go to infinity here, you can write this sum exactly as some contour integral, which you could evaluate, and then you can find the same thing that I said, the perturbative idea where the splitting between the states is actually proportional to h over j to the n. So you can get that splitting from computing this contour integral that gives you this sum. But I'm definitely not going to go into that.
Under g is equal to 1, we have the degeneracy, and then there is the
phase transition. Yes, sir. Okay, so we have one more calculation to do, which are almost out of time, but I'm just going to roughly tell you how you would do it, and then I'm going to show you the result in Mathematica. Charlie, your question?
Sorry, yeah. Could you just write down the relationship between a pi and c pi again, like in terms of like what was the definition of avian?
Right. Okay. So
maybe it would be a little more lips there.
Yes. Okay. So AK is equal to this like UK minus IV, UK CK minus IVK C minus K dagger, where UK is equal to cosine theta K over 2, VK is sine theta K over 2, and the tangent of theta k is equal to sine k over g plus cosine k. So okay, that's a bit opaque, but okay, I have a nice picture here in my notes of what this looks like. So for g bigger than 1, v of k looks like this. And UK looks like that. So you see that UK is basically always positive. So AK is also always kind of like CK. It has a little bit of CK dagger in it. And then for G less than 1, UK looks like this. And VK looks like that.
I have a confusion.
Yes.
So you act an order AK on 0 of C. You don't have to act on 0 of C. Essentially, if you act the product of A on any state, it will create, it will become the one state.
That's true, yes.
Can we choose a state where this kind of problem don't exist?
Oh, certainly you could, but the benefit of acting on 0C is that we know what the parity of 0C is.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's why we choose this state. Okay. So I think this is probably not immediately helpful, but you have to take some time to think about it because we don't have time to go through it again. But if you take these pictures, and then you should be able to derive this result. Okay, so what we found so far is that there's an exact two-fold degeneracy in the ground state up until g equals 1, and then after that it vanishes in a gap over it. Furthermore, we found that the excitation gap, not including the degeneracy, is non-zero everywhere except at g equals 1. So g equals 1 is clearly a point where something special and interesting is happening. So our claim is that g equals 1 is a quantum phase transition. And so the last thing we want to do is to give you an order parameter or a correlation function. So in particular, we argued already on back on Monday that order is detected by the correlation function of sigma x. I'm not going to repeat that argument because we don't have time for it, but this is the quantity we want to compute. So if we compute this m squared, what we'll find in the fermion language is that it's equal to this highly non-local combination of fermions. And so this looks like it'd be a huge pain to compute, but there's a trick that we can use. So let's let this quantity be called B0. This is called A1, this is B1, et cetera. So finally we have Bn minus 1, An. And H is quadratic. And then we're going to steal a technique from field theory. And we're going to use Wick's theorem to contract this by doing them in pairs. So I'm obviously not going to go through this whole calculation. In fact, I don't even really know how the whole calculation works. There's some extreme complication involved. But eventually, what we get is that M squared is equal to the determinant of a large matrix, which looks like this. Okay, let me actually make sure I get this correct, but not that it really matters that much. No, I already got it wrong. Okay. Well, actually, I guess the determinant is invariant under a transpose, so it doesn't matter, but whatever. Anyway, so we have this complicated thing where Gn is equal to 1 over pi integral 0 to pi of g cosine kn plus the cosine of kn plus 1 over the square root of 1 plus g squared plus 2g cosine k. OK, so we end up with our correlation is given by the determinant of this large matrix, where each element of the determinant is calculated by this integral, which turns out to be some hypergeometric function. So in the limit that n becomes large, this can actually be computed exactly. And I have absolutely no idea how the calculation works. So this thing is apparently called a Toeplitz determinant. And I don't really know what that means either. But if you would like to read more about this, how this exact solution works, there are references that you can find in the textbook by Sabir Sachdev, although he doesn't really explain it either. He just gives the references. He's one of the people who actually did the exact calculation. Anyway, so now I'm going to show you on my computer what you actually get when you plug to do this integral and then numerically compute these determinants. If my computer wants to be awake. Nope, it died again. Okay. Okay. Well, while this is waking up, let me then tell you what we're going to see, and a few computations that we can do based on this. And since I started a few minutes after, I will also go a few minutes late. Should be just enough time to finish the story. That's a good question. So that's I want to hold that question until I have a picture to show you. Okay, let me get my finger on again. Okay. Good. Come on. Okay. Let me increase the size. Okay. Let's see. Can we see this? So this is the integral I was just telling you. This is this GN thing. So mathematics gives us some complicated hypergeometric function. Then I've just computed a bunch of them, different values of g, and I computed the determinants. Okay, and this is the result that I get for this spin-spin correlation. So you can see this is computed at a distance of 30 spins along the chain. I would have done more, except that there's some numerical precision issues that's making the further ones not accurate. What it looks like basically is that this order is going to zero at one, except that there's some extra piece here, which that comes from the fact that it's only at a finite range. So if n were going to go to infinity, then what we'd find actually is something like this.
So the limit can be calculated exactly.
Yes. But I don't know how it works, so I can't tell you. Other than it somehow involves this topos determinant thing. So this is one thing that we can do. And then if we look at M near this critical point, or near the place where it goes to zero, what we will find is that M is equal to, for G less than one, is equal to some A times 1 minus g to the power 1/8. So also tried to show that here. Here is a log-log plot of these same correlations near this critical point, and you see they do form roughly a straight line. And I calculate the slope of this line, and from this distance of 30, the slope gives 0.116, which is reasonably close to 1/8. So that's about as good as you can expect for this short range calculation. So this 1/8 is a so-called universal signature of phase transition. Which goes by the name of a critical exponent. And in particular, this one gets the name beta, which tells you, as you approach the transition, how does the order go to zero? I'm still going to come back to your question of what actually it means to have a transition. OK, so this is one that we can compute.
And the universal signature is just the fact that it's a power law. 1/8 specifically.
Well,
so it's any power law.
So the universality, I want to come back to. So that's going to be the very last thing that I say, basically, is the question. So another thing we can do is we can say at exactly when g equals 1, we can look at sigma 0x, sigma nx will be equal to a times n to some power, which looks like this. I guess, let me use different constants. Not, it's a different constant than it was before. So We can do this calculation as well. Here. Okay, so we got a simpler form for our gn's in the case that we're at g equals 1. And so then I've computed exactly this, what I showed you on the board there, and made a nice log-log plot. And what I get is that my fitting looks like some constant b times n to the minus 0.24998, which this thing is, I think, very suggestive of 1/4, which indeed is the correct value if I really did this calculation to infinite distance. So in this case, I've computed it to 100 sites along the chain, and I got this 0.24998. So if I were to keep going and use more and more accuracy, eventually I'd get exactly n to the minus 1/4. So this eta equals 1/4 is another critical exponent. And then I guess in one, yeah, okay, I don't really have time for the last one, but I'm also going to show you another one, which is called new. And this, what this one says is for g equals 1 plus epsilon, then sigma 0 n will decay exponentially. So it'll look like c e to the minus n over some correlation length. And this correlation length is equal to d times epsilon to the minus nu. So in other words, as I approach the, so this, the correlations decay exponentially, but as I approach the transition, this C gets larger and larger and larger according to this rule. And as a result, the decay becomes slower and slower. So then the correlations go out farther in the chain as you get closer to the transition. So I sort of tried to show this here. I'm going a few minutes over today, so sorry. Okay. Yes, so there's some numerical issues which kind of mess this up, but this is a plot of this correlation length C as a function of G. So you can see that it sort of diverges near the critical point, and near the critical point also, because the correlations decay slower, the numerical calculation doesn't work quite as well. Okay, so to guess what we found, is that g less than 1 has exact degeneracy and also has spontaneous symmetry breaking. And therefore, we say that this is a long-range ordered phase. For g bigger than 1, there is no degeneracy and no spontaneous symmetry breaking. This is therefore a disordered phase, and at the point in between them, there is a transition between phases, hence a phase transition. And we say it's a quantum phase transition, where the word quantum really just implies that it's efficient at T equals zero. So it's a phase transition not as a function of increasing entropy as a result of temperature, but rather a phase transition due to changing some parameter in the system. In this case, the ratio of H over G. So now, very finally, let me comment on Charlie's question about what it means when I say this is universal. So you got these critical exponents which depend on the symmetry of the system and the dimension of the system, but they do not depend on microscopic details. So I'm not going to do anything like a proof. We're basically at the end of the class. But a sort of rough idea or rough justification model that we wrote down happen to have beta equals 1/8 exactly, nu equals 1 exactly, and eta equals 1/4 exactly. I mean, I didn't really show this convincingly, but the fact that you get these exact numbers for some model, which a microscopic model I wrote down, that's kind of shocking. Like, there's no, you wouldn't expect normally that you write down some model and you expect that you look at the decay rate of something and it's an exact small fraction of an integer, right? That's kind of bizarre. So basically the rough argument is the fact that we got all these nice numbers in this model is a suggestion that this is something which doesn't depend on tiny details of the model. Okay, so that is roughly what I wanted to get through today. And well, it's definitely not what I was hoping to get through at the end of the course originally, but things took longer than expected. But I think that hopefully you've seen an interesting survey of some topics, and you can see what you're interested in learning more about. Yeah, okay, so the end.